Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to speak to you all today about some recent work with my collaborators, Tudor, Olivier, and Jed over at Stanford. And to start us off, I'll provide a quick overview of axions and the axiverse. So axions are well-motivated extensions of the standard model. You have the QCD axion, which is hypothesized to resolve the strong CP problem, and you have string axions, which arise from the complicated topology of the extra dimensions of string theory. Now, in both cases, the axion is a naturally light particle. This is because it acquires its mass through purely non-perturbative effects. In the case of the QCD axion, it acquires its potential through strong instantons. And in the case of string axions, they acquire their mass through stringy instantons. Now, from a phenomenological perspective, we parameterize the axion potential typically as just a single cosine. This is because the axion is a periodic variable, and the overall scale of the potential is called the instanton scale, lambda, and this is the part that is naturally small. On the other hand, inside the cosine, we have the axion field divided by the decay constant F, and the decay constant, unlike the instanton scale, does live up in the UV. And this is important because the decay constant not only suppresses the axion self-interactions, it also suppresses the axion's interactions with the rest of the standard model. So this makes them viable candidates for BSN physics. So axions are scalar fields, and this means they come equipped with several natural production mechanisms in the early universe. And the one that we'll be focusing on today is the misalignment mechanism. So in order to make our discussion of misalignment a little bit simpler, it's helpful to work in terms of the variable theta, which is just the axion field divided by its decay constant. And in this variable, the axion potential just becomes cosine theta. And I've replaced the instanton scale out front with m squared f squared, okay, where m is the axion mass. Now, the story of misalignment typically goes as follows. During inflation, the universe is expanding exponentially. The axion field is stretched and flattened by this expansion so that everywhere in the universe, it acquires a single homogeneous expectation value. And to make it clear when we're thinking about the axion field as being a homogeneous field or nearly homogeneous, we will replace lowercase theta, which is a function of time and space, with capital theta, which is just a function of time. Now, after inflation, our expectation is that this capital theta can have an initial condition that lies anywhere between minus pi and pi with equal probability. In other words, we expect that the initial energy density stored in the axion field is on the order of the instanton scale itself, m squared f squared. Now, this initial energy density doesn't stick around forever. It begins to dilute because of the expansion of the universe. And we can understand this by looking at the equation of motion for the homogeneous mode. Now, this equation of motion looks exactly like the equation of motion for a damped pendulum in classical mechanics. The only real difference being that the damping is now the Hubble parameter. And the Hubble parameter depends on time. Early on, the Hubble parameter is really, really big because the universe is expanding rapidly. But as the universe expands and cools, the Hubble parameter eventually drops below the axion mass, at which point the axion becomes free to oscillate in its potential. And we can see how that looks over on the right here, where we're plotting the axion field and the potential. So we see that after just one oscillation, the axion, which started initially here, got damped down to basically the bottom of the potential, where this sine theta is well approximated by its leading order term, which is just theta. And at that point, we know how a harmonic oscillator evolves. Its energy density dilutes like cold matter, which during radiation domination means that the energy density scales like T to the minus 3/2. Okay. So that's the usual story of misalignment. And now we'll switch gears a little bit and discuss the axiverse. So in order for string theory to be mathematically consistent, you have to live in 10 dimensions of space-time. Now, I think we're all familiar that we live in four dimensions. So the extra six dimensions need to be wrapped up quite tight so that we don't observe them. And in going from the 10-dimensional string theory down to the 4-dimensional effective theory, we introduce a bunch of axion-like particles corresponding to the topologically distinct ways of wrapping around the compactified extra dimensions of string theory. And these six extra dimensions, these six compactified extra dimensions, can in general be quite topologically rich. And this leads to the prediction of a large number of axions. And this scenario is known as the axiverse. Now, each of these axions, we typically think of as living in a single cosine potential with instanton scale lambda and its own decay constant f. So lambda and f are, each axion has its own lambda, its own f. And the instanton scale is now thought of as being exponentially suppressed relative to the UV scale by the string instanton action. Okay, and the UV scale here is typically the Planck scale. Now, each of these string axions is a scalar, and therefore it can be produced through the misalignment mechanism. And this leads to the expectation that the energy density of each of these string axions, the present-day energy density, scales like the axion mass to the 1/2 power times the decay constant squared. So in other words, we expect that the axion with the largest mass or the largest decay constant will dominate the energy density of the axion sector. Okay, so this story of misalignment that I just told you is not in general true. And that is because when you have a theory of n axions, they generically will couple to one another through m instantons. So here I've written down basically the most generic potential you could imagine for coupling axions together. Here the axion phi j has its own decay constant fj. They're all coupled together through this charge matrix Qij, and each instanton has a constant phase offset delta I, and each instanton has its own instanton scale, lambda I. Okay. And each of these instanton scales is exponentially suppressed relative to the UV scale by its own string instanton action. Now, in the absence of priors on the distribution of instanton actions, we might expect that they live in a flat distribution over some interval. And in this case, that would lead to the expectation that the instanton scales are log uniformly distributed over some interval. And this roughly translates to the expectation that the axion masses are log uniformly distributed. So if, for example, I have 100 axions whose masses are distributed over 100 orders of magnitude, this leads to the expectation that each axion will be separated by, on average, one order of magnitude from its nearest neighbor. But because of fluctuations in the distribution of instanton actions, some axions will have masses that are further apart, and some axions will have masses that are closer together. And it is the axions with masses that are closer together that we will focus on, and we will call these friendly axions. Okay, so why would we be interested in friendly axions? Well, axions with similar masses have similar dynamical timescales. And because these axions with similar masses are coupled through this joint potential, this leads to the possibility of dynamical resonance. And as we'll see in the remainder of the talk, dynamical resonance can lead to enhanced observational prospects. Okay. So that's really the key takeaway from this talk. Axion friendship leads to enhanced observational signatures. This is exciting because if you spot an axion that is surprisingly easy to see, this might be the first thing that you would spot in your direct detection experiment, for example, then our mechanism provides a way in which you could search for other axions. It tells you where to look. And then, of course, once you find multiple axions, you get very excited. Okay, so with that said, I've provided some background and motivation for why we might want to think about friendly axions. And for the rest of the talk, I'll focus on three things. First, we'll go over the dynamics of homogeneous axions. So after inflation, the axion fields are flat, and we can think about their dynamics as just being coupled oscillators. And this will make the analysis relatively simple. However, inflation imparts some perturbations on the axion field, which will in general grow. And we'll discuss those afterwards. And finally, I'll discuss signatures. And we'll see that the homogeneous dynamics lead to enhanced direct detection signatures, while the density perturbations lead to enhanced gravitational substructure. Okay. So with that said, are there any questions about axiverse axions or misalignment before I move on? Okay.
Quick question. Yeah. How do you determine the QIJ? Is that just completely arbitrary?
This depends on the details of the compactification. I don't know of a simple way of determining it.
Mm-hmm. But you can expect them to be large or
what? Oh, the QIJ? In the models that I'm aware of, QIJ can be order one. It can go in particular for a theory of like 10 axions. I know it can go all the way up to 3. I imagine it could get larger for larger numbers of axions. And this, of course, depends on the details of the compactification. So I cannot make any strong claims about what QIJ looks like. It's the expectation is that it's an order one number.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, may I also ask, so just to understand your approach. So you are going to assume that there are some axions with closed masses, or there is some idea of distribution of these masses that predicts how close, how often, like axions should be?
So the approach, we are going to assume that there are two axions with nearby masses, and we're going to reduce the complexity dramatically by focusing on a specific two axion model with nearby masses, because analyzing this huge potential is of course quite complicated. The question of how how common this is, or whether this occurs in realistic string compactifications, is a question that we were actively working on, but we don't have a concrete answer for right now.
Mm. Okay, I see.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So with that said, let's look at the homogeneous dynamics of friendly axions. So as I just mentioned, the huge multi-instanton, multi-axion potential that I wrote down in the introduction is quite a bit too complicated to analyze by hand. And so we're going to focus on the following two-axion, two-instanton model that does lend itself to some analytical analysis. So here, the two axions of the theory are phi sub s and phi l, which we'll be calling the short and long axion, respectively. The labels short and long are meant to be evocative of the relative size of their respective decay constants. The short axion we will think of as having a smaller decay constant, and the long axion we'll think of as having a larger decay constant. Okay. Of course, this did not need to be the case, but this will be the scenario of interest to us. So the long and short axions are coupled together through this first instanton lambda one, while the long axion receives its own instanton contribution, lambda two. In order to make the analysis a little bit cleaner, we can go into these variables, theta s and theta l, which are just the axion fields divided by their respective decay constants. You can pull out an overall factor of the short axion mass and decay constant squared. And what's left over is these dimensionless parameters representing the relative size of the second instanton, mu and f. So in particular, mu represents the ratio of the axion masses, and f represents the ratio of the decay constants. So as I mentioned, we'll be interested in the case where the long decay constant is bigger than the short decay constant. And for things to be observationally interesting, we'll want F to be bigger than about 3. On the other hand, we want the mass ratio to live in a particular window. This is the condition of friendliness. And we'll see that we want the mass ratio to be between roughly 0.5 and 1. Okay, so the fact that this window is order 1 and that you might expect axions to live in this window is the thing that statistics will buy you, having lots of axions. Okay, so before we get into the analysis of this coupled axion model, I think it's helpful to first study the same model, except we remove the long axion from this mixing instanton. And then this is just the case, this is just two uncoupled axions, and we understand how their energy densities evolve. Both axions start out with energy density that is roughly given by their respective instanton scales. The long axion is enhanced by this factor of F squared. Mu remembers order 1. And the energy densities of both of these axions start diluting at roughly the same time because they have similar masses, which means that this initial energy density ratio persists for all time. The short axion is subdominant to the long axion by a factor of F squared for all time. And we can see this graphically in the following plot. So here again is the same potential. The long axion energy density is plotted in pink, and the short axion energy density is plotted in blue. And we see that there's an initial energy density hierarchy on the order of F squared, and this persists for all time. Okay. So this is what we would naively expect for axions undergoing misalignment in individual cosine potentials. And now we're going to reintroduce the long axion into this mixing instanton, and we'll see how the story changes. In particular, I want you to pay attention to the short axion energy density, this blue contour. It will change quite substantially. And the reason it will change is actually due to a very simple change to the short axion equation of motion. Okay, so now I'll introduce the long axion and let's see what happens. Okay, so that's a little different. The short axion energy density, instead of diluting like cold matter, stays constant for a long period of time. In fact, it stays constant long enough that at the end of the evolution, it dominates the final energy density, exactly contradicting our intuition from two uncoupled axions. And the reason for this change must come down to the fact that the long axion now acts as an external driver of the short axion. Okay. But remember, the long axion has a frequency that is detuned from the mass of the short axion. So if the short axion were to, say, live in a harmonic oscillator potential, then we would expect no significant energy transfer between the two axions. Okay. Because the masses are detuned. You would only expect significant energy transfer if the masses were tuned so that the long axion was driving the short axion on resonance. So it must be that the fact that the short axion lives in this nonlinear potential that is allowing this large energy density transfer from the long axion to the short axion. So the reason for this is that a classical pendulum can have any frequency smaller than its rest mass. Okay, so this could be familiar from your everyday experience, but the easiest way to see it is, for example, if you hold like a pendulum in its unstable equilibrium, for example, this pencil I'm holding, in its unstable equilibrium where it's being held upside down, its period is infinite. It's just going to stay there forever. But if I deviate it ever so slightly from this unstable equilibrium, Now its period is large but finite. Okay. So a pendulum can have any frequency between zero and its rest mass. Now, this means that if the short axion has the correct amplitude, it can be driven on resonance by the long axion.
Yeah, may I ask you something here? Yeah, I'm a bit confused. So why do you expand linearly in the long axion field? And you keep sine for the short axion, I understand for the reason that you are describing, but why you are expanding in the long axion?
So the long axion starts out with a lot of energy density. So early on, it doesn't really care that the short axion is there. So its energy density quickly dilutes. And after like the first, few mass times of evolution, its amplitude is small enough that you can use a small angle approximation.
Well, you see what I don't understand just if I write down the equation for the short axion, I will get sine of theta s plus theta l.
So absolutely, there is a cosine of theta s here. I'm doing this for pedagogy. So absolutely, the equation is a little bit more complicated. In fact, the fact that you have a cosine theta s here means that if the short axion amplitude becomes too big, then the driver goes away. And this will ultimately be a cutoff for us. But for the sake of being simple, let's ignore that. Then we have just the case of a driven pendulum, which is much easier to talk about, I find. We can discuss that.
But are you saying that this cosine is irrelevant? Doesn't change anything? I think it does.
It's irrelevant until it's not. It's irrelevant until it's not. So if the short axion amplitude is small enough that, like, I see what you're saying, right? The nonlinearity in this potential, in this term here, let me be clear. As long as theta s cubed is bigger than theta l theta s squared, it's consistent to neglect the nonlinearity, consistent to neglect that cosine. Okay.
Okay.
So,
I see.
It strictly speaking, like, we should not neglect it, and we don't neglect it when doing like the actual calculation. But really, like, the key physics is captured by this equation.
Good. I see. Okay. Thank you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So So the point is that the long axion is driving the short axion off resonance, but because it lives in a nonlinear potential, or lives in a cosine potential, its frequency can be anything between 0 and 1. If it's oscillating at the correct amplitude. So it can be on resonance at a particular amplitude. And the process by which the short axion dynamically adjusts its amplitude so that its frequency matches that of the long axion is called autoresonance. And it is this process that will be the subject of the next several slides. Okay. Any other questions about this plot? Okay, so over the next several slides, I'll try to address the following two questions. What are the dynamics of autoresonance? So how do you actually get from generic initial conditions to this special amplitude where you resonate with the long axion? And how friendly do axions need to be for autoresonance to be common? And to begin addressing the first question, the place to look is the resonance curve. Okay, so here we're plotting the equilibrium amplitude of the short axion versus the relative driving frequency of the long axion. And the equations that we'll be looking at are these equations. They're just the same equations as before. You'll notice that the damping and the driving have these slow time dependencies. They're slow when t is bigger than 1. And in order to make the resonance curve kind of a well-defined thing to look at, we need to take the adiabatic approximation, where we neglect the time variation of these coefficients over the oscillatory timescales of the short axion and the long axion. So in this case, where we're neglecting these slow time evolution, we get a notion of equilibrium. And in the case that the short axion lived in a harmonic oscillator potential, in other words, neglecting the sign, we would just get the resonance curve we are all familiar with, where the maximum response is achieved when the frequency of the driver is tuned to the frequency of the driven oscillator. Okay. But once we introduce the nonlinearity, we remember that for a pendulum, its frequency decreases with increasing amplitude. And ultimately, this bends the resonance curve to the left. And this leads to the possibility that you can have up to three equilibrium amplitudes. In particular, at this driving frequency, we have what we call a linear resonance. And we call it a linear resonance just because it's close to the blue curve, which is the linear oscillator. You have this new unstable resonance, but it's unstable, so we don't care. You'll never get there. And then we have this nonlinear resonance. Okay. This nonlinear resonance is where autoresonance is taking you. Okay. So that's where the short axion was hanging out when its energy density was constant. So the reason it could even hang out at that energy density for a long period of time at all is because this nonlinear resonance is stable. Okay. So now, in order to understand how the short axion got to this nonlinear resonance, we can look at how these quasi-equilibrium configurations, or these quasi-equilibria, evolve in time. So now we're going to sweep these amplitudes, and we're going to see how the short axion either gets lifted up to the nonlinear resonance or dropped down. And in particular, what we'll see is that when the short axion is driven closer to resonance, but not exactly on resonance, it gets lifted up to the nonlinear resonance. And when the short axion is being driven too far off resonance, it gets dropped down. Okay, so let's watch this movie, and we'll see how this point gets lifted up and this point gets dropped down. Okay, so what happened here? Well, the resonance curve effectively grew underneath this frequency here, but it just kept dropping here. Okay, and ultimately the reason for this is that the damping early on is bigger than the driver, but at late times, the damping falls off faster than the driver. So the resonance curve evolves from being flat, meaning that the damping is larger, to this very weak damping limit represented by the dotted curve at late times, because the damping at the end will be much bigger than the driver.
Okay. Hey, David, can I ask you a quick question?
Yes.
So going back to the original plot that you showed, where you have the long guy and the short guy, there you showed that the density of the short guy was kept constant.
Yes.
So how am I supposed to understand this? I thought that the reason it's kept constant is that the rate at which you lose energy from the long guy matches the Hubble rate. How does that agree with what you just said, that the Hubble rate, the friction term goes down, and I'm just a bit confused. Well,
the long axion is having its energy drained in two ways, right? Mm-hmm. One, it's losing energy to Hubble friction, mm-hmm. and two, it's losing energy to the short axion. Mm-hmm. And the short axion, in order to be like the short axion, can only be at one amplitude.
What does that mean?
Like the equilibrium mm-hmm. is at a particular amplitude. And so the long axion needs to transfer exactly enough energy that the short axion stays at this fixed amplitude.
So how do I see that? Is this plot that you just showed now? It's, the amplitude was increasing.
The amplitude of the short axion?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, this early period where the amplitude is increasing.
Yeah.
This is a relatively short period of time.
I see.
Yeah. So the real kind of like the place where the energy density is constant in that plot is really, you know, you can see the curves are still slowly changing. Like, yeah, this is where you have the constant energy density.
I see. The oscillation in the energy density, what is it set by? Like you had, there were some overtones. Is there a physical frequency there?
There is a physical frequency. It's a little complicated. You can understand this, but it's a little complicated.
Okay, then we can come back. I don't want to derail your talk then. Continue. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, sounds good. So we saw that this point got lifted up and this point got dropped down. So what exactly set the threshold? Let's watch the movie again, and this time we'll pause at a key point. Okay, so here we see that the resonance curve becomes vertical here. Any point to the left gets dropped down, and any point to the right gets lifted up. Okay, so we have this notion in which the masses cannot be too far apart to get autoresonance. Okay, so that's really all I have to say about these resonance curves now. So what we've seen is that autoresonance is just the equilibrium evolution of a damped driven pendulum. It's just the equilibrium evolution of a damped driven pendulum. And the equilibrium, the endpoint of autoresonance is just the nonlinear resonance of that pendulum. Okay, any questions about this before I move on?
Okay. May I ask, like, what is that number set by?
Which number?
Like this 0.7 something.
So this depends on the initial amplitude of the long axion. It really scales like 1 minus mu to like the 3/4 or something like that. This is what the threshold is. And there's some order one number out here. We can discuss that later.
Okay.
Yeah. The actual, how does this point scale is, as you can see, it's not super straightforward. Now that we've addressed what the dynamics of autoresonance are, we can look at the question, how common is autoresonance? And before we study the coupled two-axion model, we can look at the uncoupled model from earlier. Okay, so here again, the short axion lives in its own cosine potential, and the long axion lives in its own cosine potential. Here we're plotting the long axion initial amplitude versus the short axion initial amplitude. And in color, we're plotting the final energy density ratio. Okay. In the white regions, the long axion dominates. And in the black regions, the short axion dominates. Okay. And what we see is that in this uncoupled axion model, the short axion only dominates in this small sliver here. And this is exactly what we would expect. Only when the short axion, only when the long axion starts out with basically zero initial energy density, can the short axion dominate the final energy density. And this is because the ratio is just fixed by initial conditions. The initial ratio is the final ratio. Okay, So now what happens when we introduce the long axion to this mixing instanton? Okay, something quite different happens. So we notice the emergence of these two gray bands above and below, where the short axion now dominates the final energy density ratio. Okay. Now, if we remember, on autoresonance, the short axion effectively siphoned all of the energy density away from the long axion. Okay. So when the short axion dominates the final energy density, is a good proxy for when autoresonance has happened. And what we see is that this autoresonance band takes up roughly the same amount of parameter space, initial condition parameter space, as the non-autoresonant regions. Okay. I also want to point out that the center of this plot, where the oscillators are firmly linear, looks just like this plot. Okay, so when the initial amplitudes of the long and short axion are small, no nonlinearity matters, and we're left with just the naive expectation. Okay, and you know, as I pointed out, we have some analytical understanding of where this threshold is. And it's this complicated dependence on mu. Okay, any questions about this plot before I move on? Okay.
What is the gray?
Sorry. What okay.
Sorry, yeah. What is happening in the swirly gray?
Yeah. So the swirly gray. The gray itself, right, represents regions where the short axion dominates the final energy density. Right. Mm-hmm. And this is, again, a good proxy for when autoresonance occurs, because the short axion siphons all of the energy density from the long axion. These intricate swirls represent initial conditions where the long axion kind of shoots the short axion off on a chaotic trajectory. Once you start bouncing over multiple vacua, you're really going to experience chaos. And that's what these striations are.
I see. The
important point is that these striations are roughly a 50-50 distribution between autoresonance and no autoresonance. Like, once the chaotic evolution stops, you either end up on autoresonance or you don't. And it's a 50-50 shot.
Okay, thanks. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, they're very interesting, but they're also very complicated. Okay. So this plot gives us a snapshot of what happens at a particular mass ratio, 0.85, but what happens at all other mass ratios. So we kind of want to look at all possible plots like this for various mu, but that's rather difficult to do. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at this plot, which is a little more complicated, but it contains all of the information about how many initial conditions end up autoresonating. So on the vertical axis, we have the short axion energy density over the long axion energy density measured at some late time. And on the horizontal axis, we have the mass ratio of the long to short axion. And each vertical slice of this plot should be thought of as a histogram over the space of initial conditions, just like the previous plot, where the darker regions represent final energy density ratios that you're more likely to end up at. Okay, so in particular, between say 0.5 and 0.75, you expect the long axion to dominate, and you expect it to dominate by roughly a factor of say F squared. When in this region between 0.5 or 0, that's one, between 1 and 1.5, you expect the long axion to dominate again. And over here, it dominates by about a factor of F squared. And over here, you see that we achieve roughly equipartition between the two axions. And this is because of a linear resonance. So this is still totally expected, even from our naive linear expectations. However, there's a conspicuous absence of long axion domination over here. Instead, what we have is this, what we would call an autoresonant tail up here, which is kind of an exact inversion of what we would have expected from a linear theory. Okay, the short axion dominates the final energy density in, or rather is expected to dominate the final energy density ratio between about 0.75 and 1. Okay, so in order to kind of quantify how likely it is for the short axion to dominate the final energy density ratio, we can simply add up all the points above the horizontal axis. And remember, you know, when the short axion dominates the final energy density, this is roughly interchangeable with when autoresonance has occurred. And we plot this in this inset over here. So on the vertical axis, we have the fraction of points lying above the horizontal axis. And did I say horizontal? I meant vertical axis. And on the horizontal axis, we're plotting mu. And we see that between 0.75 and 1, there's between a 25% and a 75% chance that the short axion ends up dominating the final energy density ratio. In other words, there's between a 25% and 75% chance that the short axion experiences autoresonance in this band, okay? So this range between 0.75 and 1 represents our notion of friendliness, okay? So with that said, we've addressed the two questions we set out to answer. The dynamics of autoresonance are just the quasi-equilibrium dynamics of a damped driven pendulum. And in order for autoresonance to be common, we found that the mass ratio needs to be in this order 25% window. The theoretical range over which autoresonance can occur is somewhat larger, but once you get down towards this theoretical minimum, really you require fine-tuned initial conditions for this to occur. And to go back to a question that was raised earlier, this has to do with the long axion driver actually having a cosine theta s term multiplying it. Okay, so this term eventually vanishes, and that's when the driving frequency is too detuned. Okay.
So then, can I ask you something? Since this mass range seems to be more or less small, what happens when you take a multi-instanton corrections to the potential or something, or you take a potential that is more realistic? Do your predictions stay firm?
There are, you can add more instantons, and there are ways in which adding more instantons can, you know, lead to qualitatively similar results. And there are ways in which adding more instantons can completely change the expectation. One way that you could imagine adding an instanton that would totally, you know, derail our expectations from this autoresonance is just, let me go back to the equation. Okay, is if I just added 1 minus cosine theta s, and I multiplied this by some larger number. Okay, so in other words, the mixing instanton would not be important. It would just be these two instantons. And then you would get just the normal story, right? However, if this term is smaller, then you don't care about it, and it's the mixing instanton that matters. Okay, and then our story goes through unchanged. So, does that address your question?
I mean, but in principle, this is, I guess, calculable, right? So
it really depends on the model. I mean, you know, what kinds of couplings you expect between axions are you know, they depend on the specifics of the compactification. And this is something that we are currently looking into.
So, yeah. May I ask a follow-up question, like similar to Daniel? Like, let's say like you add this term, where 1 minus cosine theta s, like how small, how much smaller does that mass has to be compared to either the long or the short one? Like, well, or the potential height, I mean, has to be, like for that term to be.
I guess what I'll tell you is that you can add this term, and it can be order, it can be on the same order as this term.
Yeah.
And it will not destroy the autoresonance, it will simply change it. And in fact, what we did in the paper is we added this third instanton to create repulsive self-interactions. And these repulsive self-interactions lead to some interesting consequences that we can discuss later. So I guess what I will say is, as long as it doesn't dominate, you know, by some huge amount over this mixing term, it can change the quantitative result, but it will not change that autoresonance can happen.
Sorry, David, to ask about this, because the coefficient of this term, if you express it, so m squared f squared, basically it goes like e to the minus s, where s is some action. So the point is that that exponentially depends on parameters.
Yes.
So the probability that you have these parameters being close to each other looks like you need some values to be very close to an exponent of something.
I have a slide prepared for this question.
Let's come back later.
We can discuss this at the end. It's a backup slide, but yeah, we can discuss this at the end. I don't want to get too into the weeds right now. So we've addressed the question of what is autoresonance and how friendly axions need to be. And we can discuss how am I doing on time? I'll just lightning go over density perturbations, because I think this is already a familiar topic to this audience. So during autoresonance, the short axion is held at large amplitudes where attractive self-interactions are strong, right? The fundamental frequency of the short axion has been significantly detuned from its rest mass, representing strong attractive self-interactions. And because inflation imparts a spectrum of initial perturbations on the axion, these perturbations want to clump up due to the attractive self-interactions. And these density perturbations can have observational consequences, but they can also disrupt autoresonance if they become nonlinear before the end of autoresonance. In fact, if they start collapsing under their own attractive self-interactions before the end of autoresonance, we see that these perturbations, or rather, they're no longer perturbations. We see that these nonlinear structures quench autoresonance. And this happens if the autoresonance lasts too long. In other words, if the initial energy density hierarchy is too big, then expect non-perturbative structures to quench the autoresonance. And this happens if the decay constant ratio is bigger than about 20. Okay. And just very quickly, here is a plot of energy density versus time. And in white and beige, we have our expectations from the homogeneous theory. And in pink and blue, we have the results of a 3+1D simulation. And what we see is that when non-perturbative structures form here, the energy density of the short axion begins diluting like cold matter again, and the final energy density ratio is fixed from that point on. Okay. So in other words, the short axion receives a constant enhancement to its energy density, or rather a constant multiplicative enhancement to its energy density once the decay constant ratio exceeds roughly 20. And increasing it beyond that point would only serve to raise the blue curve up. The pink curve would stay roughly the same shape. Okay, so with that said, I'll now briefly go over direct detection signatures. When you're looking for an axion that was produced cosmologically, you typically look for...
Sorry, David, can I ask? So going back to the takeaway, so what scales get enhanced? Are there scales that get enhanced or...
Oh, sure. Yeah. So the scale that gets enhanced is roughly the size of the modes that are roughly the size of the horizon when the axion starts oscillating. Yeah.
Which axion?
They both start oscillating at the same time.
Because it's the same.
Similar mass,
it's those scales.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Same as large misalignment.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. Actually, perturbations grow a lot faster here because, you know, you're being held at a constant large amplitude instead of decaying. Yeah.
What kind of simulations you did here for this inhomogeneities?
What do you mean by what kind? Like what numerical method or?
No, I mean, did you simulate the field on the grid? Yeah, like three-dimensional grid?
3D grid, yeah. 3D grid with a spectrum of primordial perturbations on the metric.
I see.
Yeah.
So this number 20, this critical number 20, can it be estimated or just pure result of simulations?
You can absolutely estimate it. I mean, so 20 is just how long you, it basically comes from knowing how long you have before the linear perturbations, which are growing exponentially, become order one. And so our linear theory estimate for when things become kind of nonlinear would be right here. But in fact, autoresonance is only destroyed once these large perturbations start collapsing under their own self-interactions. And so you get this constant offset that is coming from numerics.
I see. Well, I think you can estimate when they start collapsing also from some model like pressure.
Oh, sure.
Or something. Yeah.
No, sorry. They're collapsing not under gravity. They're
right. I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You could also, I mean, even so, you could still do an estimate of when these structures should collapse from their own attractive self-interactions. But yeah, the easy quantity to estimate is when they grow bigger than one. And, you know, for it's pretty much close enough. I mean, this represents a you know, percent level change in F. So, okay. So with that said, I don't want to linger on this too much because, you know, the exciting stuff is direct detection and indirect detection. So, and I'm happy to discuss more afterwards, by the way. Okay, when we look for a cosmologically produced axion, we do so by building a haloscope to look for the dark, for the axion in the galactic halo. And in the case of the axion-photon coupling, the halo axion comes in, it scatters off of a strong magnetic field and produces an outgoing photon. And the intensity of the beam of outgoing photons scales like the axion photon coupling squared times the ambient axion energy density. Okay, so this is the figure of merit that we care about when making predictions about how good our direct detection experiments are. Now, before talking about the cold model, let's again consider a single axion living in a cosine potential. Here that we know the final energy density scales like the decay constant squared, and the axion photon coupling is expected to scale like 1/ the decay constant squared. There can be order one numbers here, but generically, you know, this is kind of the fiducial expectation. And what this means is that our figure of merit, GA gamma gamma squared rho, is independent of the decay constant. Okay. And what this means is that an axion that, say, comprises all of the dark matter has the same observational direct detection prospects as an axion with a much smaller decay constant that is just a tiny subcomponent, as long as they have similar mass. So when building a direct detection experiment, we're not just looking for the dark matter, we're looking for subcomponents of the same mass. In the case when we're looking for misalignment produced axions, at least. Okay, so what does this look like on a plot? So on the vertical axis, I have this figure of merit, axion photon coupling root rho. And on the horizontal axis, I have the axion mass. And here are a bunch of direct detection experimental prospects. And each of these lines corresponds to the signal strength produced by a misalignment axion with an initial misalignment given by 0.1 pi, 0.5 pi, or 0.999 pi. And the important thing to note about this is that to get above this 0.999 pi signal strength, you really need to get really fine-tuned initial conditions. And this is possible. You know, several people in the audience have constructed a model where this can happen. But in the absence of a dynamical reason to be at the top of the potential, you really expect the axion to live in this band. Okay. So in other words, experiments like ADMX, DM radio gut, clash, and so on, should be able to see misalignment produced axions. But experiments like Brass and Mad Max really would require you know, either fine-tuned initial conditions or a photophilic axion. Okay, so any questions about this plot? The axes are a little bit weird, but okay. So in the case of our coupled two-axion model, the long axion transfers basically all of its energy density to the short axion. In other words, the short axion energy density is enhanced by a factor of the decay constant ratio squared relative to the expectation for a lonely axion living in a single cosine potential. In other words, the short axion has a large axion photon coupling that, because of its small decay constant, and it has the large energy density coming from the large decay constant of the long axion. Okay, and as Jed likes to say, you get the best of both worlds. You get a stronger coupling and more axions. Okay.
But is that, and sorry, David, is that fair? Because I mean, you're relying on these masses to roughly match because you have a large number of axions. But on top of your long axion, you have an even longer axion, naively, that has even larger energy density because you have so many axions. That's your logic. So why will ROS dominate and be the thing that you look in direct detection and not the even longer axions?
Sorry, what do you mean by even longer axions?
I mean, here you have a model with two, but you're saying, okay, they have similar mass because in reality we have hundreds of them and two of them sure. End up, right?
But well, right, but like what, I guess my question to you would be, why does the even longer axion have better prospects than this axion?
No, I'm just saying that in the end, if you have 100 axions, I don't see the reason why this one that you're calling the short axion that underwent this autoresonance.
Right, so I guess my
dominate the phenomenology for direct detection.
I will answer this question in the following slide, but okay. The thing that I want to remind you of is that our expectation is, say you have, you know, a lot of axions in your axiverse, you would expect them all to live in this band here.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter how, quote, long or short they are, how big or small their decay constants are, they'll all live in this band. So if I'm building my direct detection experiment and it goes down, 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 I only expect to see things once I am able to probe this band. Okay. So, you know, it doesn't matter that there is an axion in my theory with a bigger decay constant or a bigger mass. It will not be easier to see.
Sorry, that. Anyway.
I guess I should say, like, yes, these do have some mass dependence. So in that sense, they could be easier to see. Okay, yeah.
So at what point you're gonna overclose the universe?
Oh, sure. So if you take F too big, you'll overclose the universe. But the point is, we don't care about how small of a subcomponent we're looking for. So in that sense, you know, if you are looking at a decay constant that is too big, because it overcloses the universe, you simply take it smaller and then you won't overclose the universe, but your prospects do not change.
That's not necessarily how it goes, right? It depends on what you keep fixed and what you vary.
I'm talking
here
about
you're assumed...
at fixed mass.
Eh?
At fixed mass.
Yeah, but there is also different parameters. The initial condition, there is a phi. You're varying a phi and you're keeping the initial condition fixed. That's not necessarily how it should work, right?
This absolutely, because you know it might be that inflation takes place at a lower scale, and you don't actually get bumped around to these higher field values. So this is absolutely
no,
true.
But even if you're bumped around, you need to take anthropic considerations if you have some anthropic range. So what you constrained is a fact of the sum of theta squared of all axioms of some sort. So it's not clear that you have to be in this. It could be that one is dominant, the other is not.
Second.
Let's come back to it later because I mean we're running late already.
Yeah. Sorry. I guess like what I'm trying to say is like if, for example, your field range, you know, could not be so large. Like say you were considering an axion with an initial displacement of 0.5 pi, and I increase the decay constant. And now that initial condition is excluded because you would overclose the universe. Anthropic considerations would mean that this theta has to be smaller, and it would have worse observational prospects. Right. Maybe I'm misunderstanding the question, I'm sorry. Okay, so the point is that the long axion transfers its energy density to the short axion. Okay, it has a bigger decay constant, so the short axion has a larger than expected energy density than by a factor of roughly F squared. Okay, so here is how these enhanced prospects would look. I plot them in these blue bands here. These shaded blue regions represent the range of signal strengths you could expect for a long axion with initial misalignment of 0.5 pi. If the long axion has a slightly larger initial misalignment, say 0.9 pi, then you can get up to these dotted regions here. Okay. And so, for example, if I'm building my experiments and I get better and better sensitivity, eventually I might say enter this friendly band and I might spot something here. And then I say, well, you know, this axion could be many things. It could be photophilic, it could have fine-tuned initial conditions, or any number of other things. But it could also have a friend. And then if it has a friend, I have a very sharp prediction for where that friend should be. I could build another experiment that looks in the nearby mass range, and you could look for the friend. Okay. If, for example, the friend is in a part of parameter space that is too hard to reach, if you take this scenario seriously, then you might also say, well, the friend is too hard to reach, but I could also build a broadband detector to look for other axions. Because in order for this guy to have a friend, you have to live in a moderately dense axiverse. And this would predict other axions in this mass range here, for example. Okay. So with that said, I just want to point out that friendly axions are highly visible. And if you find a highly visible axion, you can do two things. You can look hard at nearby masses to confirm that it is in fact friendliness or that it's not friendliness that is responsible for this highly visible axion. Or you could do a broadband search to look for other axions well outside the mass range that kind of have to be there in order for friendliness to not be fine-tuned. Okay. So with that said, I'll briefly go over gravitational dissection signatures. Unlike the direct detection signatures, which did not care about whether the friendly pair was all of the dark matter or just a subcomponent, here we care because the perturbations in the short axion will only collapse under their own gravity if the short axion is the dominant energy density in the universe. So if it is, if the short long pair is the dominant dark matter, then the short axion perturbations will collapse and they'll form dense galactic substructure. And we plot this in a halo spectrum. So on the vertical axis, we have the density of substructure. versus its mass. And in white, we have the cold dark matter prediction. And in blue, or rather all these other colors, we have the expectation for various friendly scenarios. And what we see is that we get enhancements of up to 10 to the 3, 10 to the 6, or 10 to the 4 in the density of substructure. And these very dense substructures can be searched for using gravitational lensing probes. So here I'm plotting the decay constant ratio versus the axion mass. And this decay constant ratio, I want to point out, is on a linear scale. For example, for this photometric microlensing constraint, you only need a decay constant ratio of about 3.5 in order to have observationally interesting deviations from CDM. These constraints over here on the, or sorry, these prospects here on the left come from astrometry using Theia and SKA. These can also constrain relatively small decay constant ratios, or discover relatively small decay constant ratios. The decay constant ratio cannot be too big. Okay, if it exceeds about 20, then the short axion does not receive all of the energy density from the long axion, because autoresonance is quenched by the formation of non-perturbative structures. So as you go above F of about 20, the short axion is still a subcomponent, the perturbations in the short axion no longer collapse. Okay. So, any questions about this plot? Okay. So finally, to summarize, I just want to say, for like the third time, friendly axions are more visible than lonely axions. If you discover a highly visible axion, then this should prompt a search for more weakly coupled axions at nearby masses. And if you discover a friendly pair, this is very exciting, because you found evidence that we live in a dense axiverse. Okay. And now I'll just briefly mention some possible future directions, some that we're currently working on as well. We're currently looking into the dynamics of axions in realistic string compactifications. It's all four of us plus Virov Mehta over at Göttingen. We are interested in performing simulations of the matter power spectrum resulting from the formation of nonlinear structures, for example, in the short axion. There's the possibility that these nonlinear structures can be supported by the presence of the long axion, leading to interesting long-lived oscillon signatures today. Finally, I'll mention that, you know, in this talk, we've only discussed the case of two-axion friendship or two-axion dynamical resonance, but you could also imagine other more general scenarios where, say, one axion transfers its energy to one friend, and then that friend transfers its energy to another in what we would call a friendly cascade. You could imagine that you have two axions whose masses are not related to one another, but for which some rational combination of their masses yields the mass of another axion. And in this way, you could have what we would call a rational resonance. Finally, just to highlight the point that autoresonance is an extremely general concept, in this work, we've only considered the case where the short axion is undergoing small oscillations around the bottom of its potential. But if the short axion receives a large amount of energy density so that it's now performing complete circles, now the thing that's oscillating is no longer the angle. Instead, the velocity is oscillating. So as the short axion comes down, its velocity increases. And as it goes up, its velocity decreases. And these velocity oscillations can be autoresonantly driven by an external driver, just like the angle. And this opens up another possible mass ratio range for possible autoresonances as well. So with all that said, I'm sorry for running over. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Yeah, thank you, David. Here's a virtual applause. If there are any questions in the audience,
Yeah, can you go back to this signature of the structures? Yeah, you had this plot, you went quite fast over it, so I want to understand better.
Yes, sorry about that. I'm just running a long time.
What are the masses and sizes of structure you're looking for here?
Yeah, so down here at lower masses, the structures are around 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 solar masses. As you go up towards larger axion masses, the structures are smaller because the wavelength of axions is smaller. Here's precisely the relationship. So you can see that as you increase the axion mass, the size of structure, the mass of structure decreases the 3/2 power.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and where do you expect to have these structures now? So say 10 to 9, 10 to 8, these are like big things. Yeah. So do you expect them to be in the centers of the galaxies or where? Flying around?
In that range, you might expect that, these are, you expect galactic halos to be composed of these objects, right? Mm-hmm. So you would have, maybe a central, dense guy and then many dense guys floating around it. A very rough analogy is like, you could think of each of these mini halos as being, particles that form mm-hmm. up a halo,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, there must be some bounds on that from the dynamics of galaxies. So some kind of disk broadenings, disk thickness, increased due to heating. Basically, these guys flying around will hit the galactic disks. Perhaps also perturb stellar systems. I don't know, like globular clusters, binaries, perhaps as well. So, have you looked at that?
No. This is an interesting point. I need to look more into that. Yeah.
And sizes, so and what are their sizes? Okay, so masses are in this range, and size, what is characteristic size here?
Yeah, so the size of these structures is related to, I don't remember off the top of my head. The size of the overdensities is, the horizon size, which is roughly given by the axion mass. And then this grows because the universe is expanding. Mm-hmm. Until matter radiation equality, and then the structures collapse. So,
mm-hmm.
It's roughly related to I'm not going to attempt to do the calculation in my head right now, mm-hmm. But it's related.
But it's kind of complement wavelength, so corresponding to the degree of velocity of the structure, is it?
Say one more time. I'm sorry.
Is it of order Compton wavelengths that corresponds to the structure, or it's something else?
It's something else, and this is, at the center of these mini halos, you can have solitons uh-huh. where the radius is related to the quantum
uh-huh.
wavelength.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but the overall mini halo, it does have a relationship to the mass. I just can't remember off the top of my head,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not going to try to do it right now. Yeah.
Okay, I see. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Very interesting.
Thanks for the question. Mina, you had this question about how likely this actually is.
Yes.
Yes. So, this, of course, is a question that we are currently trying to address by looking at realistic, compactifications.
Mm-hmm.
So in particular, Liam McAllister's group has put together a database of type 2b compactifications, and we're currently looking at those. Aside from that, here, like I guess the way I would address this point without actually looking at a particular model, I mean, it's hard to say anything without, you know, being specific about the model you're looking at. But, you know, here's how I might address your point. So what we really care about is that, you know, some ratio of instantons lies in some order 25% interval, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what this imposes is a relationship between two instanton actions so that they lie in some order 0.5 interval.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, David. I thought like the masses is within like the 0.25 interval.
That's right. And this roughly corresponds to the instanton.
The actions are like 200. So the actions are like 200, Junwoo.
I will
go. So the actions are like, this is like one per mil.
Right. So okay. So regarding Curly's point, so this C represents like the offset from the decay constants. Okay.
Yeah, that's a bigger number than 0.5, no?
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is that you still need to lie in an interval of order 0.5, right?
Okay.
It's just now offset. And so if you imagine that the S's are uniformly distributed over some fixed interval, let's take the minimum instanton action to be smaller than the maximum. You're shaking your head, Nina.
Yeah, because I think this reasoning doesn't take into account that you require that these actions couple.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So then there is the question is a conditional probability. I agree, the probability that you find two actions close to each other can be alleviated if you have many actions.
Yes.
But if you there is an additional requirement is that the actions couple with each other. So this is not a complete argument.
No, I mean, like, I guess, you know, the problem with, you know, I'm aware of this. The thing that makes it difficult is, you know, the way the axions couple together depends on the details of how of the model they descend from. So, you know, I
see. Look, I consider this a one per mil accident. That's the bottom line. Because you require that two cycles intersect to get a common thing, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And those cycles, mm-hmm. in principle, are order one different. So you require not only that you have two mass eigenvalues that are nearby, but you also require that those eigenvalues that are nearby also couple, which is a strong requirement that's...
Yeah, and so they are not coupled to other things, right?
Like, yes, if you couple exactly. to
other things, that's not okay. But the fact that requiring that they are not coupled to other things is not entirely necessary, right? I mean, they can couple to other things. It just depends on things like mass ratio. So, for example, if you're coupled to something, For example, if you're coupled to something with a much bigger mass,
Within your mass range, right? Like you are saying, like these are the two things that are coupled to each other.
Yes, for example.
But like, for example, like as Daniel was saying, like you can have like a very large F axions. Of course, in order to not overclose, their theta angle initial has to be zero, right? Close to zero.
Sure. Not like order one. I mean, we're dealing with a ratio here.
And then, like you for those like it feels like. You just have a cosine theta small, right?
Yeah.
Short.
Sorry, if you want to argue, by the way, this is what Junwoo is trying to say, that if you want to do statistics of dark matter abundance with 100 axions, you need to take the contributions for all 100 axions in whatever argument you want to present.
Sure, yes, I agree. I guess, if you have like, imagine you have, there's like in a single axion scenario, imagine you have a decay constant. So fix the mass, Say you have order one initial misalignment, there is a decay constant that will generate the correct dark matter abundance.
But
axions that are lighter will be subcomponents.
But I don't understand why you fix FA and then you fix theta and not scan F and keep FA. For a given compactification, the FAs are fixed, and what are scanned by inflation is theta.
Yes.
You cannot keep theta fixed and ignore everything and say that you're domin. So the other thing is, you're also, by that statement, you're assuming that it's the largest FA axion that is the friendly axion, is not necessarily. No.
That's not what I'm assuming. I'm like, imagine. Sorry. Now we have to walk all the way back.
Yeah. The other question I have is, why don't you form a lot of topological defects if that's what you assume for the initial condition?
Sorry. My thing froze. Okay. My iPad is frozen now. Okay. Well, my screen is still working, so here. So my point is just that, imagine, like, here's like the most naive thing I could imagine. You know, each, I guess this is the wrong axis to look at. Okay. Suppose, every axion that is produced in, can you see this now? Oh, you can, good. Every axion, suppose every axion has, order within an order of magnitude, similar decay constant. Okay. The masses will span many orders of magnitude. Let's imagine that the decay constant is such that, ignore the actual value of the mass, by the way. Imagine that any axion with mass bigger than, say, here, has to have an initial misalignment that is smaller than order one, so that you don't overclose the universe. Then everybody left of this line is a subcomponent.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and so I'm just saying, axions to the left of this line, we don't care that they're subcomponents. All we care about is the decay constant ratio, which, enhances the energy density relative to what you would have expected.
Sorry, that also assumes that GA gamma gamma for each one is the same, that the ratio depends on the ratio of a phase, which is not, right?
It does assume that, yes.
So
I mean, it's a fine assumption to make, but it's not clear that.
No, of course.
By the way, we're getting very late, and the people, sorry to interrupt you, David. I think we need to stop the recording because there is some poor person from PI that is paying attention to this, and they need to stop the video. So we can continue this offline.